So in this Q&A session, what we can do is you can just raise your hand if you have a question, and then when I call on you, of course, you'll need to say who the question is for, because we have all three of our speakers for today here. And actually, I'm going to start it off just because I remember one question that was asked during John's talk. And I actually wrote an answer, and I suggested that maybe it would be good to ask John during the Q&A. So the question was from Liu Jun Zhu, and it was, how important is the assumption that the local Hilbert space is finite dimensional? So that was part of the setup in the beginning. And then this assumption does not hold for canonical bosons or quantum rotors.
Okay. Yeah, that's a good point. I think actually it's not so important in those contexts, because when studying canonical bosons or rotors, we always add a Hamiltonian, which penalizes the very high occupation number states, either of many bosons or many momentum, high angular momentum states of the rotons and so rotors, but effectively that makes the Hilbert space finite dimensional. So I guess maybe the important assumption is that there's a, that I wanted to make was to have a finite number, finite dimensional Hilbert space, effectively finite dimensional Hilbert space at reasonable energies. And I guess the thing that I wanted to rule out there I spent many years thinking about applying ADS-CFT, trying to apply ADS-CFT to condensed matter physics. And one of the difficulties with doing that is that that description is useful the gravity theory is classical in a large n limit, where n is the number of degrees of freedom, roughly the number of degrees of freedom at each site. And I wanted to not talk about that. So that was really my motivation for saying that.
Okay, good. So let's move on to another question. So, I see. Josh, you might need to make me a co-host. It looks like I can't unmute people. Now I can do that. Okay, so we have a question from Ethan Lake. So Ethan, you should be able to unmute yourself and speak now.
So this is also for John McGreevy. I was wondering if you could maybe elaborate a little bit on your statement that we expect critical points that don't involve Fermi surfaces in greater than one dimension to have area law entanglement scaling. I'm wondering if this is like related to some kind of intuition, like Merman-Wagner-esque intuition, where lower dimensions have higher fluctuations or something. So, say a few words about that.
Yeah. Okay. So good. I was worried someone was going to ask this, because I don't know any kind of proof of the statement. It's true in the examples we know, but there is, any kind of nice argument for it. Along the lines you were describing, right? It would be nice to say something like that, but maybe you can translate this into that. So one feature of critical points is some kind of scale invariance, and so one way to think about the structure of the entanglement in such a state is to take advantage of that scale invariance and think about this notion called entanglement per scale. So think about maybe making some kind of hierarchical construction of the ground state coupling in degrees of freedom sort of hierarchically. I guess, examples of tensor networks which realize this precisely are it's called the multi-scale entanglement renormalization nonsatz mara. So maybe the best argument for the statement is such a network violates the area law in one dimension, namely, I guess maybe should I try to draw a picture? I don't know if I should. Well, okay. Imagine. So maybe. You know, imagine one of these pictures of hyper, like these Escher paintings, pictures of hyperbolic space that people draw, and replace the angels and demons with tensors. So that's a picture of a mirror for a one-dimensional state. And if you compute the entanglement entropy of a subregion in such a in a state like that, one way to think about it is to count one way to bound the entanglement entropy of such a state is to count how many bonds of the network you have to cut to separate out the region in question from the tensor network. And you know, it's in the nature of hyperbolic space that you know, there are more and more angels and demons as you get close to the boundary. And so that's where the logarithmic violation of the area law comes from in one plus one dimensional critical states. If you draw the same picture, or it's harder to draw, but if you make the same kind of tensor network in higher dimensions, more than one spatial dimension, you can still implement this notion of scale invariance and constant entanglement at each scale. But if you measure the now to estimate the entanglement entropy of a subregion, you have to compute the area of some region. So you know, instead you're computing, you know, the number of bonds that you're cutting is proportional to the area of some surface that cuts out the region, and that no longer has a logarithmic divergence in D bigger than one. So I don't know. That my understanding of it is as this kind of geometrical property of self-similar tensor networks. But I think there should be a better argument.
Great. Okay. So if that answers the question, we can move on to the next one. So next we have a question from Milan Shayani. So Milan, you can go ahead. You should be able to unmute yourself now. Great.
Hi. This question is for Subir.
Hello.
Hi. So you talked about the lattice SYK model and the TJ model. And in the lattice SYK model, you said that you don't get interesting physics at all the way at the low energies. Is it because you don't have the SYK dots between different sites coupled to each other? And should I think of the TJ model as like the lattice SYK model, but now where you have, say, two fermions from one dot talking to two fermions to some other dot, and then you just sort of average over them?
Yes. So I don't know. Can you see the picture? No. Let me share my screen.
The reason I ask is because maybe this TJ model is the first systematic way of trying to solve SYK lattice models.
Right. So, So what's happening here in the SYK lattice model is you have this island, and each island has n electrons with some average interaction u, and you take the limit of large n. So it's like a multi-orbital atom where the number of orbitals on each atom goes to infinity. And because of that, it doesn't matter how large U is on the average. It doesn't know about the discreteness of these levels. I mean, they become very incoherent very quickly. And so it never is an insulator, no matter how large U is and no matter what the filling. The TJ model is the case where N is two. So each island has exactly two states, spin up and spin down, that's it. And what's random is the T. There's a T between any pair of islands. So really the picture is, I don't have a, maybe I can draw it on the board.
Whiteboard.
Yeah, so it's basically, well, okay. You have a bunch of sites. Each site can have only two electrons, spin up or spin down, or zero, or W occupied. That's it, there are four states per site. And then you can go from any site to any other site with a hopping matrix element T, and you can have an exchange between any pair of sites with hopping matrix element J. So, of course, you know, that real world is a square lattice, but it's a square lattice with some disorder. The fact in the real world you get a spin glass state, well, this is some kind of mean field theory then for that spin glass state and the way the spin glass state disappears as you increase the doping. So that's the, you know, real only justification for it. But somewhat surprisingly, then you also get linear resistivity. You get a lot of other properties that seem to match the real world. I don't think the ultimate transition in the real world will be described by this random TJ model. It's some much more complicated finite dimensional model with disorder and strong interactions. That's really well beyond our ability to solve. But the solution that I didn't really present but outlined, you know, I would say is a very good mean field theory to start to solve the ultimate problem. Yeah.
It was, sorry, just one last thing, which is, so there was this work done by, I think, all the papers that you mentioned, and then I think there was a paper by Shaolang and Douglas and friends where they took a translational invariant lattice model where they had chi-i, and then chi-i plus one, chi-i minus one, some sort of coupling like that. But the disorder averages only at one spot, you only land on the leading saddle only gives you the solution where you're diagonal in position as well. And I was...
These are details, but in the end, their model is, I mean, in fact, I should have given them credit, but I don't know. Sorry, it seems like their name is not down here. But this is just basically a generalization of their model to higher dimension, to complex fermions, and so on.
Yeah.
I mean, their model has each side has many, 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 many fermions.
Yeah. Now, I was just wondering if you had any idea of how we could go about starting with a model where you now have disorder over different sites and still be able to solve it?
I'm not sure of what you're referring to, but I think I've shown you what I think we can partially solve. Almost anything you do makes life much more complicated, at least in these TJ models.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. So let's move on to a question from Adarsh Patri. So Adarsh, you should be able to unmute yourself now.
Great, thanks. I have a question for Sabir. It was about the non-zero extensive entropy you were discussing. So you mentioned that is not actually telling us about, you know, ground state degeneracy, but it's rather reflecting like an exponentially small many body level spacing.
Correct.
I was wondering, is that related to the residual entropy people often talk about for in multi-channel condo problems, where this sort of similar limit is taken, the large L, I guess, before small t?
Yes. I mean, in fact, the calculation that, that's a very good point. The calculation that you do to compute this S naught is quite analogous to the calculation you do for the multi-channel condo problem. Uh-huh. In fact, George and Farquhar had worked on that before, which is how we discovered this.
Okay.
But the big difference, of course, is here for the condo problem, it's just one site. So the entropy is a number of order one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, here, this is an entropy on every site. So this is really more like a multi-channel condo problem where the bath is self-consistent with the multi-channel, with each site.
Mm-hmm.
So, and so you get this contribution, not just at the boundary, but at every site. So it has a factor of N in front of it, mm-hmm. which is missing. There's no factor of N in the multi-channel condo. It's just there. It's just, you know, some entropy of order one.
Mm-hmm.
Here it's, you know, this is really a consequence of self-consistency is really crucial. At the surface, it looks somewhat similar.
Mm-hmm.
But now if you look at, for example, fluctuations, the full density of states, you know, that's described by Schwarzschild theory here and gives you the cinch density of states. That doesn't happen for the condo problem. For the condo problem, there is no self-consistency. Mm-hmm. There is no time of transition invariance. There's no Schwarzschild. That's really, so all those features are quite different here. But there is some superficial similarity.
I see. Yeah, because I often see they mention things about like non-universe, I mean, some kind of ground state degeneracy in the multi-channel condo problem. So I guess I was getting a bit confused. Okay.
Yeah, they sometimes say it's a ground state degeneracy, which is not an integer, but it's an integer of non-integer of order one. here it's the entropy is also not an integer, but it's about n.
Okay, thank you.
I have a question about the zero temperature entropy. Did I hear correct that you mentioned, you said something like you think it's an inevitable consequence of a system without quasi-particles, maybe with some other assumptions?
In zero dimensions.
Oh, in zero dimensions.
Certainly not in zero space. If you don't have, if it's a zero dimensional problem, yes, I think it's inevitable.
Okay.
Any
okay.
of these, roughly speaking, they always look like areas too, right?
Okay. Okay, I see.
Good. Actually, John, I saw in the written Q&A that you had a question for Monica that you wanted to ask about glassy phenomena.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So I wanted to ask Monica, so in these long range spin hopping systems that you studied, I mean, those are a lot like models, like the model Sabir was talking about, which people studied as models of spin glasses. Do you see any glassy phenomena, or do you expect to?
So I think that this is a really exciting direction for us to look at. So I would say so far we've been focusing on just getting the control of the interactions and characterizing what we have in a simple case. But in the work I showed at the end where, you know, we're moving to a situation where by basically programming the drive field, we can control the structure of the interactions. I think a natural thing to do would be to ask, for example, you could make a system with sign changing interactions, which is something that shows up in spin glass models, right? And I showed a nice ordered array, but we could also easily move around the positions. So now we have a way of sort of naturally making translationally invariant couplings, which seems maybe a little bit too ordered, but we could also certainly add disorder in the positions of the sites. And I think that that would be probably a very natural way to start getting glassy physics. And so, yeah, that's something we would love to explore.
But in the case where you have a gas though, where you don't place them in particular places, you don't see any symptoms of glasses.
Well, so far, again, we've in the gas. So first of all, I'll just mention, I'm not sure I was very clear about this. So we're working in a system where basically the atoms are kind of spatially pinned. I think I sort of glossed over that, but they're pinned spatially and they have this long range interaction. And so far, I kind of showed that much of what we're seeing can be described in sort of a picture that it's some collective spin, that's it's a sum of these individual spins with some weights, but there's a fairly simple understanding of well, for example, there's a ferromagnetic ground state in the ferromagnetic case, in the anti-ferromagnetic case, as I showed you, there was this sort of symmetry where it actually, the let's say Ising anti-ferromagnet behaved a lot like an XY ferromagnet, and that had to do with this sort of collective coupling of many atoms to the cavity mode. So one sort of wants to have more randomness in the couplings, right? So where I can't think of it as this single large spin, and the ability to start breaking the kind of all-to-all connectivity, or breaking this idea that basically the form of the couplings is separable and just given by the product of individual atoms to the cavity mode, and going to richer coupling graphs, I think is probably a necessity. And so that's, I would say, with these sort of latest developments in the control of the interactions, I think that's a natural way to get there. There's an alternative approach which involves having not just a single cavity mode, but many cavity modes mediating the interactions. And Sabir and also my colleague Ben Lev have sort of done theory on that. And that's sort of an alternative method of getting into the glassy regime.
Cool.
Good. So I see a question in the Q&A, which I'm pretty sure is a question for Monica. So the question is from Hao Geng, and it's how can one create a Gaussian disordering in experiment? Like I interpret it as like a, you know, some interaction in the Hamiltonian, which is taken from a Gaussian distribution.
Yeah. So, and I think this again comes now to the question of what exactly do you want Gaussian disorder in? So if you want random JIJ couplings with Gaussian that are drawn from a Gaussian distribution, There's some challenge in doing this in a single mode cavity, because what we naturally get are couplings that are the products of the couplings of individual atoms to the mode at different sites. So you sort of have like n parameters that you can tune, as opposed to just like n squared random couplings. So then, and again, so now there are sort of two tricks. One is have many, many cavity modes, but you sort of want, if you really want sort of Gaussian random couplings, that should scale with the number of spins. Or you, again, start playing some of these tricks where you break the all-to-all coupling and then reintroduce the interactions. And I have to say, I haven't sat down and figured out, can we make something that's Gaussian random JIJ couplings by that method? But it seems that with the control of the positions and the control of the couplings versus distance, there's actually, one certainly can introduce randomness.
Great. Okay. Here I have a question that I can read for John. So this is from Songyang Pu. And the question is there any case that two phases of different topological orders happen to have the same entanglement entropy?
Okay, yes, certainly.
Right, yeah.
Right, yeah, Mike, maybe you should answer.
Well, I was thinking I wanted to start saying the answer as I was reading the question.
So
can go ahead.
Yeah, so I only talked about, just as, you know, I talked mostly about this one sort of characteristic quantity, which is the topological entanglement entropy in 2+1 dimensions. You know, that measures one number, often distinguishes different states. But for example, we certainly know some examples of degeneracy in that number. For example, the Tor code has four ground states on the torus, and so does the double semion topological order. So this motivates finding more refined ways to distinguish topological orders. And I guess this gives me an opportunity to mention something which is mentioned in my notes that I didn't get to say. So in the context of the claim that the data about at least a gapped phase is encoded in the ground state wave function, I wanted to mention that this statement has really been brought to its a very highly developed form in the form of what's I think should be called the entanglement bootstrap. It's a sort of perspective that's been developed by Bo and Shi and collaborators, Isaac Kim in particular, and Yuan Ming Liu, where the idea is to start from just the reduced density matrix of a pat on a patch of space in one of these ground states, and by cutting it up in various ways and trying to glue it back together, one can infer basically all of the data of the associated with the topological excitations of the system. So far they've succeeded in 2+1 dimensions in learning how to extract the fusion rules and breeding data from this kind of procedure. The only input is really a wave function that satisfies these conditions for topological order. With a slightly more refined analysis of the entanglement structure, one can distinguish all the phases that we, at least so far, know how to distinguish, at least in 2+1 dimensions so far.
Good, okay. So I know that Ashwin told me that he has a question for Monica. So before Ashwin asks his question, I don't see any hands raised right now, but this might also be a good time to think about if you have a question that maybe didn't get answered before that you'd like to ask, because this is probably almost the last chance to ask it, at least today. Anyway, in the meantime, Ashwin, why don't you go ahead with your question?
Yeah, so it's sort of a more general question about architectures for quantum simulation. So you told us about a couple of approaches, the cavities, the optical cavities, and the Rydberg atoms. But if you were to look more generally, if you were to pick one or two other promising approaches, what would that be at this time to really go towards this sort of general quantum simulator?
Sure. So, I mean, I think, of course, part of the whole idea behind quantum simulation is that you're not necessarily building a universal general purpose device, but that you have different physical platforms that are well suited to studying different types of problems, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think, for Bose and Fermi Hubbard models, if I just want, local interactions and hopping, there's an amazing class of experiments done in, quantum gas microscopes to study those models, and that's great for certain classes of condensed matter problems. But if we focus on sort of this idea of more general forms of interactions and being able to have long-range interactions, I think, certainly another very nice platform are trapped ions. So in the same way that we let atoms interact by coupling them to photons, ion trap experiments essentially engineer long-range spin-spin interactions by sort of mapping spin excitations into phonons back to spin excitations. So there's a fairly strong parallel there. Mm-hmm. There, in terms of just the coherence of the interactions, ion traps are certainly ahead. And actually, one of the hard things about working with photons is that photons have this nasty tendency to leak away out of your system and easily becomes dissipative. So there are, however, some challenges in terms of there are just sort of limits to how many ions you can easily have in a single chain. And so far, and they're in principle, all kinds of things are possible in terms of local optical addressing. But in practice, sort of much of what's been done has been limited to sort of certain power laws of the interactions. But I would say certainly trapped ions are a very powerful system for this type of, long coherence times and long range interactions and programmability. Yeah.
Okay, great, thanks.
Okay, good. Now I see that there are some more questions. So first I see that Subir has a question. If you want to go ahead, Subir.
Oh, I think we're running out of time. Maybe I'll defer to the students. I can ask John later.
Okay. Yeah, we can go over by at least a few minutes here, I think. All right, let me move on to Mateo Wilczek for the next question. So Mateo, you should be able to unmute yourself and speak now.
Hi, I have a question for Subir about, models you described, the TIJ always had a zero mean. Are some of these models still solvable if TIJ has a non-zero mean? And does anything interesting happen?
Certainly for TIJ, there's nothing. The mean of TIJ can just be absorbed in the chemical potential. So that's not really serious. But if you have in the SYK model, if the U alpha beta gamma delta had a non-zero mean, I think that doesn't change very much again, other than some renormalization of the chemical potential. But if you go to the TJ model and you take a non-zero mean, that becomes complicated. Then you can get ordered antiferromagnetic states and other types of gap states showing up in infinite dimensions, and that makes the whole this particular large long range limit is not terribly useful. I mean, it's really designed for spin large or spin liquid phases, a gapless spin liquid phases that we have discussed.
Thank you.
Great. I see one other question again from Ethan Lake. So Ethan, you should be able to unmute yourself now.
It's again for John about the kind of characterization that you were giving of Hilbert space. You had this have this small collection of states that will are all the states we'll ever see, and then everything else, right? So I'm wondering, when you say all the states we'll ever see, is this from the perspective of a theorist who's interested in working on tractable problems, or is there some kind of non-entanglement, some kind of big resource that's needed to create these states? If I have some strongly interacting electron system and I act on it with, you know, some medium, large number of electron creation operators, like, do I not just create some random state out in this big kind of non-reachable part of Hilbert space, or?
Right, good. Yeah, so there are some precise statements along the line of what I had in mind, which, where I guess the, maybe the, yeah, the perspective, here's, take the following perspective. Everything we do in an experiment or in, you know, thinking about preparing states is really just time evolution by some Hamiltonian, right? I mean, sometimes, you know, some people get to decide what the Hamiltonian is, but you know, even then you choose the Hamiltonian and then wait. And so what I meant by most of that ocean of volume law states is inaccessible is it's actually, so there's one concrete result is it's actually not possible to reach nearly all of them by time evolution by a local Hamiltonian starting from, you know, say start from a product state for in a time polynomial in the system size. So and this is, it's really just a counting argument. Like,
but I could maybe reach them quite easily by acting with some like creation operator or something like that injects some energy.
Well, let's see. So I guess, okay. So I think you might be right actually that if you allow yourself to prepare states by non-unitary operations by maybe like Euclidean time evolution or like you're saying, just like acting with a bunch of non-unitary operators, you're right. You may be able to get farther than what I'm saying. But I think there is something meaningful in the statement that the way that states are actually made, like in experiments, is by unitary time evolution by a, you know, some Hamiltonian. Maybe, you know, maybe the Hamiltonian has longer range than what I'm imagining. But actually, the argument I'm talking about, actually, it just needs to be k-local. As long as the Hamiltonian involves only k sites at a time, even if they're distant, a counting argument shows that you can't the overwhelming majority of the states are inaccessible. If you evolve for a time polynomial in the system size. So now I guess we could also argue about, you know, whether a time super polynomial in the system size is something we should think about. I don't know. So this was the statement I had in mind, but I think you might be right that we should, it might be a good idea to be open-minded about thinking about other ways to prepare states. I don't know how to implement acting with creation operators, because you know the particles have to come from somewhere else, right? And so the thing you're really doing is adding a term to the Hamiltonian, which allows them to hop from somewhere else into your system, which you know would be of the kind of form that I was talking about. So I don't know. So that's the spirit of what I had in mind, and so really the important thing is a counting argument that the number of parameters involved in specifying a random state in this ocean of high complexity states. Yeah, it's actually enormous. And really, actually, I should emphasize, it's not really the entanglement of the states that's big, it's the complexity, right? And that's the sense in which they're inaccessible, that it would involve doing more things than we have time for to create them.
Okay, great. So there's one more question, and then I think this will probably be the last one since we've pretty much run out of time here. And so that's from Andreas Elbin. I think Andreas, you said you have a question for Monica.
Yes, thanks. I wanted to ask about the last part of the talk where you see that you have introduced that. The multimode drive to engineer arbitrary couplings, and I want to ask to go to to measure in the end autox in the system, what's kind of limiting the system size you can reach there, and what are the methods to you think are best suited to measure in the end autox and potentially even the exponential growth there?
So in terms of what's limiting the system size, I would say it's essentially that, you know, there's some region over which we have this tightly focused optical mode, which is order a millimeter. And, you know, right now we have 20 traps that are spaced pretty far apart in that region, but scaling it to sort of, I think it could be scaled to sort of order 100, let's say, in a fairly straightforward manner. Now, I should emphasize that everything we've done so far is working with kind of small ensembles on each site. And so so this gives a benefit for us in that actually it gives us a collective enhancement of the interaction between the atoms. The drawback is, of course, it becomes a bit more kind of semi-classical, right, in the sense that I should think of it as sort of a large spin on each site. So that's one caveat. And sort of to push it to a more quantum regime and still have a long enough coherence time, one really needs significant advances in the strength of the atom-light coupling. So that we should keep in mind. But then in terms of, one certainly could start to measure autox in this system. And I think that actually so there are a couple of different options. There are some schemes that involve doing some sort of an echo protocol. So sort of roughly measuring chaos by asking about, you know, what happens if you try to evolve forward and backward in time at sort of a hand waving level. And that is in principle possible in our system in the sense that we can, as I showed, have either sign of the interaction. And so you could reverse the time evolution. There's a question of what fidelity you can do that with. So that's an experimental challenge. Then there's the class of schemes that I believe you, Andreas, have worked on, which involves basically actually only needing to evolve forward in time. That's nice. And basically probing operator growth by preparing many different random states and watching how they evolve. And so this, I guess, I think there have been some trapped ion experiments now using this type of an approach to measure scrambling. And that's something that would be very natural in our system in the sense that essentially the ingredients one requires are some local operations to kind of prepare a random state and then time evolution and essentially measuring spin correlations. And those are all capabilities that are very natural that we're basically already implementing in our system. So I think that the ingredients are there, and we want to start with simple systems that aren't chaotic and make sure we know what we're doing before the harder part of seeing whether we can characterize chaos in the system. So it's certainly where the toolbox is starting to be there.
Thank you.
Great. Okay, so before we wrap up, I have one quick announcement. So there was a request to set up a happy hour on Remo, a chance for people to discuss further. And so that's been done. And so Stephanie Moll has sent out a link to that to all participants. So you should have received that email now. And that link has been created for the whole week, actually. So there will be a chance to talk more after the Q&A session each day. And just important point, that's a separate Remo link from the one that's actually in the PDF schedule, that because of some technical issues, it has to be that way. But there's an email that everybody just received just a few minutes ago from Stephanie that has that link in it. So if you'd like to chat more, you can do that there. Otherwise, yes, there will be a new Remo link for each new day for the happy hour. That's what I'm being told to emphasize. Okay, good. So otherwise, we'll be back tomorrow at 11 a.m. Eastern time. And thanks to all our speakers and to everybody for participating today. All right.